So while my presentation is loading, I have no conflicts to disclose. Okay, so today I'd like to talk about challenges and payoffs in developmental origins of health and disease. And first, I'd like to thank my colleagues in the obesity prevention program, and much of the work that I'm going to present today is from led by junior faculty and trainees in the program. So today I want to address a couple questions. The first is, to what extent do events during early human development affect health outcomes over a lifetime? And then, what can we do to alter these events to improve health? So I'm going to give you a preview of the conclusions. Firstly, that I think we need to have a new generation, take advantage of a new generation of epidemiologic studies with innovative study designs that look at new risk factors and that involve the developing countries and, in our country, low-income and minority populations. The second is that we need an interdisciplinary approach to understand mechanisms, not for the sake of understanding mechanisms, but for what they tell us about etiology and prevention. And then to talk about preventive interventions that are developmentally appropriate and systems-based. So mostly what I'll be talking about today is obesity and its common complications, diabetes and cardiovascular disease, which are the leading causes of death and disability in the developed world and emerging in the developing world through the nutrition and epidemiologic transition, from the major causes of disease and mortality being infectious and perinatal, to those being more chronic, like obesity, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, cancer, and mental health. Today, a lot of what I'll be talking about is childhood obesity. Well, we know that obesity in childhood predicts adult consequences. So here in an example from the Pima Indians, whether we measure body mass index in school age, early adolescence, or late adolescence, you can see that the higher the BMI, the more the prematurity mortality due to what they called endogenous causes here, which includes diabetes and cardiovascular disease. But it's also important to remember that childhood obesity is not only bad because it predicts adult consequences, it's bad for the child. And on this slide, you can see schematically many of the organ systems that are affected by childhood obesity, including psychosocial domains, pulmonary, including asthma, musculoskeletal, cardiovascular, which we're talking about today, and type 2 diabetes. Well, we're having a childhood obesity epidemic. Remember when we used to have to fatten the kids up first? Is one way to look at the epidemic. Another way is to look at trends. So here is the obesity trends over the past 30 or so years, showing a steep increase in our school age, our adolescents, and even our preschool children. And this is happening not only in the US, but around the world. Here you can see increases in childhood overweight in many countries. On this slide, we have mostly countries from the developed world, but here you can see that it's occurring in the developing world as well. And today, I want to focus on the fact that the obesity epidemic has spared no age group, even infants. So these are data that we culled from our sister HMO, looking at heights and weights from well child visits over a 22-year period from 1980 through 2001. And you can see even down here among our infants, the 0 to 11-month-olds, there was a monotonic, almost linear increase from 1980 through the early 21st century. So this message is that the obesity epidemic has spared no age group, even our youngest children. We know that once present, obesity tenaciously resists treatment, not only because behaviors are set, but also because physiology is set. And so the implication here is that prevention must start early. And this brings us to this paradigm of developmental origins of health and disease, which emphasizes the prenatal period in early childhood as important for development of chronic disease throughout the life course. In animal models, perinatal programming of adult obesity-related outcomes is well known. And by programming, we mean that some perturbation or insult at a critical period of development causes alterations with lifelong, sometimes irreversible consequences. And this makes sense teleologically, because so much of our development happens in the first 9 months after conception through infancy and early childhood, here depicted as cell divisions. Now, if we go back 50 years, we can see an example of this. These are the classic studies of Widdowson and McCants. And what they did was they took litters of rats, and typical litter has 9 pups, and they took 6 of them and gave them to the other mother. So we have 2 mothers, one with 15 pups to suckle and the other with 3. So you wouldn't be surprised that the mothers who are feeding 3 pups rather than 15, at the end of 21 days, which is weaning, they have bigger pups. So here we have that. More surprising was, even after the weaning period, when they got the same chow, these that were in the litters of 3 still had higher weights than those in the litter of 15. And looking at this graphically, you can see that this 21-day period of food restriction led not only to reduction of weight at that point, but also a lifelong reduction in weight, even if normal chow was given to the rats. And in fact, when they repeated the experiment around here in so-called adolescence of the rat, they got only, when they reduced energy intake at about 12 weeks, they got only a temporary reduction in weight, and then they caught right back up. So this indicates that there's this critical period of feeding in the early postnatal period in the rat that has lifelong consequences. And now if we move to the present day, there have been many, many animal studies showing that you can induce these adiposity and cardiometabolic consequences in many species ranging from rodents up through non-human primates. And they're relatively easy to induce through diverse interventions in the perinatal period, including nutritional ones like I just showed you, but also administering hormones, tying off the uterine artery, and inducing anemia and hypoxia. And these observations, these phenomena, are due to environmental alteration of genetic expression, not to genes themselves, but, for example, to epigenetics, which we'll come back to in a minute. So let's take an example that shows that not only do these perturbations cause disease in the next generation, they can also be intergenerational, generation after generation. So for example, if one induces gestational diabetes in an animal model, the babies are bigger at birth, they have more adiposity when they grow up, and if they're female and get pregnant, they're likely to get gestational diabetes themselves, which induces obesity in the next generation ad nauseum. And so there are now plausible mechanisms that explain these phenomena, probably due to insulin or leptin resistance in the hypothalamus. And so what we're left with is this idea that there might be an intergenerational vicious cycle. So gestational diabetes gives rise to obesity in the next generation, which is a big risk factor for diabetes and cardiovascular disease. Well, obesity is the biggest risk factor for gestational diabetes, and you could see it could go in a cycle. And this could be very important because diabetes is increasing rapidly worldwide, including in women of reproductive age. And so by 2030, some estimates are that 1 billion people in the world will have diabetes or prediabetes. So these animal models are proof of principle, but what's the translation to humans? Of course, animals are not people. Rats have different placentas than humans do. Typically, the animal experimenters induce things with much higher doses than we'd see in the physiologic range for humans. But they do, you know, they do suggest exposures and pathways. Well, epidemiologic studies in developmental origins of disease really got its start, as Michael was saying, with the historical and retrospective cohorts, especially by those of David Barker. And for those of you who hadn't seen, there's a flyer in the back. Professor Barker is actually getting the March of Dimes Agnes Higgins Award later today, and there'll be a reception, and you can hear Professor Barker talk at 4:30 in the Hyatt Regency. And I see that food and beverages will be served, so that should attract many people. Anyway, as Michael said, these original studies really assess the relationships between birth weight and later outcomes like diabetes and cardiovascular disease. But since then, people have gone to other study designs. So resurrection of old prospective cohorts like the Collaborative Perinatal Project, and more recently, new cohorts of pregnant women and children, one of which is Project VIVA, which is our Boston area cohort, and also the US National Children's Study, which will, I hope, at some day get off the ground. So if we go back to our question about gestational diabetes and obesity in the next generation, how do we do in epidemiologic studies in humans? Can we actually see a relationship between gestational diabetes, birth weight, and later adiposity? Well, let's take a look at some of the studies. One of the nicest studies that's been published is now 10 years old from the Pima Indians. And in this study, Donna Dabilia and colleagues showed that siblings who were exposed to diabetes in utero, shown in the black bars, had higher BMI starting in school age and going through early adulthood than siblings who were not exposed to diabetes in utero. And the SIB-PAIR design is a nice one for leading us towards etiology, because SIBs, to a large extent, share the same postnatal environment, and to a certain extent, share the same genes. So when we're looking at a prenatal factor like gestational diabetes, the SIB-PAIR design can be very valuable. Well, the Pima Indians are endemic for obesity and diabetes, and a number of other studies, including ours here I'm going to show you in a minute, tried to look at this in general populations. This study is from Growing Up Today study. These are sons and daughters of the nurses in the Nurses Health Study. And you see, once we adjust for a number of factors, including mother's own body mass index, the relationship between gestational diabetes and odds of adolescent obesity is really hard to show. Odds ratio of 1.2, confidence interval 0.8 to 1.7. So one of the questions is, in a population like this, especially of nurses, where they might have gotten more adequate treatment than others, could treatment of gestational diabetes have actually prevented the otherwise deleterious effects of gestational diabetes on the next generation? So, if the slide will go. Yikes. Okay. So a couple years later, Teresa Hillier published this study. This actually used data collected in HMOs in Oregon and Hawaii. And what she said, what she asked was, is the risk of obesity at age 5 to 7 lower with treated than untreated gestational diabetes? So this is based on the oral glucose tolerance test, the non-fasting and the fasting glucose tolerance test that women get during pregnancy. And she could divide the cohort into those who had normal glucose tolerance. If they failed that, then they went on to the fasting test and maybe they had a normal test. Or maybe they had prediabetes or impaired glucose tolerance, or maybe they had frank diabetes. And the ones that had diabetes, some of them got treated and some of them didn't. Well, you can see that in comparison with those who had normal glucose tolerance, those who had diabetes and weren't treated had almost a twofold risk of obesity. Here, weight for age at age 5 to 7 over the 95th percentile. But those who were treated for obesity actually had a lower risk, actually closer to those who had IGT. So this was a hint that adequate treatment of gestational diabetes might lower the risk of obesity in the next generation. But again, it's an observational study and it's still subject to confounding. So the best way to test this hypothesis is to follow up kids whose mothers participated in a randomized controlled trial of treatment of gestational diabetes in pregnancy. And so there was this really nice study published in 2005 by Caroline Crowther and all, showing that treatment of gestational diabetes resulted in a halving of macrosomia from 21% to 10%. And so the question was, if you follow up the kids, what's their obesity rate? So When I was doing a mini sabbatical in Adelaide, Australia a couple years ago, we found out that the government of South Australia actually has a surveillance program where they measure height and weight in almost all 4 to 5 year olds. And we're able to link these two databases to answer this question. And what we found was there was no effect. So if you look either at body mass index as a Z-score or at the odds of BMI above the 85th percentile, you can see that there's really no evidence that the treatment of gestational diabetes resulted in lower obesity at age 4 to 5. Then the question is, why is that? So how do I go back? Okay, so one possibility is that it takes a while for the effect of gestational diabetes on childhood obesity to reappear. So Boyd Metzger showed some years ago that the offspring of mothers with diabetes are heavier at birth, but then they become very close to the control group, and the excess weight only starts to appear in school age. Nobody knows why this is. In our data in Project Viva, it tends to confirm this. So here we're looking at gestational diabetes versus no diabetes, and looking at outcomes at 3 years. And you can see there's no effect on body mass index. There actually does appear to be effect on more direct measures of adiposity. Here's the sum of skin folds, and here's an adverse consequence of obesity, higher blood pressure. So maybe even though we're not seeing effects on body mass index, there are effects on the adiposity and the physiology, which we really should be measuring. So anyway, this, I think the gestational diabetes obesity example brings up a couple things that lead to my first set of conclusions. And one is that our epidemiologic studies should start to look intergenerationally, that we need to really take advantage of innovative study designs like follow-up of kids whose mothers participated in randomized controlled trials, the SIB pair design, taking advantage of biomarkers in epidemiologic study, and some other things like Mendelian randomization that I didn't mention. I implied that we need more data in developing countries where obesity and diabetes rates are increasing rapidly, and certainly in low-income and minority populations. We published this article led by Elsie Tavares a few months ago, showing that many obesity risk factors that we and others have identified in the pre- and perinatal period are more prevalent in blacks and Hispanics than they are in whites. So whether that be gestational diabetes or depression or weight gain in the first 6 months of life or lack of exclusive breastfeeding, et cetera, many of these really tend to occur more often in racial ethnic minorities in our country. Okay, interdisciplinary approaches. So fortunately, developmental origins of health and disease is an inherently interdisciplinary activity. And really, it's important that we see this as multidirectional. So we have population studies, we have clinical studies, animal models, in vitro studies. They really interact with each other to really deepen and broaden our understanding of this field. And so for example, this is going back to the slide I showed earlier, you can see that there are many ways in animal studies to induce bad things in the pregnant woman. And in fact, we've gone in this field well beyond the initial focus on undernutrition of the mother to say, well, yes, diet during pregnancy, but also other behaviors like physical activity. Looking at the placenta is a very active endocrine organ. Thinking about fetal metabolism, and then going upstream, mother's own periconceptional health, and going back even further in this intergenerational focus, her own intrauterine and childhood experiences, whether they be environmental, social, behavioral, or biological. Well, sometimes I think this is about as simple as it gets, and more often it looks something like this. So that's why we need a computer. There are many people interested in systems approaches to looking at developmental origins and how we can tease out the most important, both linear and feedback pathways. Well, we shouldn't despair too much. There is now an increasing emphasis and interest in epigenetics. So just a few words about that. These are, thanks to Rob Waterland for sharing these slides. He and Randy Jertle and others have done these now classic experiments where they alter the amount of methyl donors in the maternal diet around the time of conception. And so what happens is when you alter methyl donors, you modify DNA methylation. Well, DNA methylation is the most understood of these epigenetic mechanisms. Epigenetics means above genetics. DNA marks on genes upstream from the genes can affect how the genes actually function. So in this experiment, what they did was they gave, as I said, either a large amount of methyl donors or a small amount of methyl donors. If you give a large amount of methyl donors, sort of the adequate amount in a diet, it turns off this gene downstream, and the mice become thin, brown, long-lived, like the wild-type mice. But if they get under-neutrophied with methyl donors, such as vitamin B12 and betaine and choline and folate around the time of conception, they wind up being totally different. They have yellow coats, they're short-lived, they're susceptible to cancer and diabetes. So we don't usually think of identical twins having different skin color or having really different disease rates, but you can think of these mice as being identical twins, and they have the same genotype, a really different phenotype, because they have this different epigenotype. And I think epigenetics is actually kind of exciting in developmental origins because it could possibly unite this human and animal data. But we have to think about the fact that some of these factors don't cross species, and that oftentimes all we can get in our epidemiologic studies is blood, and what we really want is target tissue. But really, we need longitudinal studies from conception into childhood and adulthood with biomarkers. And we're trying to do this in Project Viva. We're looking at something called line one, a measure of global DNA methylation in pregnancy and at birth in relation backwards to maternal dietary methyl donors and forward to phenotypes that are related to obesity and cardiovascular disease. And so far, in preliminary data, we found that higher global DNA methylation in cord blood is associated with some factors that we've previously identified as risk factors for obesity. So higher placental production of corticotropin-releasing hormone, lower leptin in cord blood, and rapid infant weight gain. So this is an area that I think is really coming to the fore in the developmental origins field. So in conclusion from this part of the talk, epidemiologic observations lead to basic investigation. And the animal studies have at some points been ahead of us in developmental origins and sometimes behind us population-based researchers. And now I think there need to be more animal studies in some of these newer risk factors we're finding, gestational weight gain, maternal smoking, diet such as vitamin B12 and vitamin D. And these mechanistic studies help prove causality. Again, I think there's a danger. A lot of basic scientists say we need to find the mechanism just to find the mechanism. But when we think about the circle and circling back to population-based studies, it's about understanding etiology and causality, which helps us know what preventive strategies to take. Okay, I've talked mostly about before birth, but believe it or not, what happens after birth is also important. And so a number of studies, including ours and Project Viva, have shown that rapid weight gain in the first 6 months of life leads to later obesity and cardiovascular disease risk factors. So here we can see in Project Viva that obesity at age 3 is much higher in those who gained a lot of weight in the first 6 months of life. So here's weight at birth, weight for length at 6 months. And we found a similar thing for blood pressure at age 3. Those who had the highest blood pressures were those that were actually born the smallest and gained the most weight in the first 6 months. But when we think about weight, and weight gain, it's not really a monolith. What we're really saying is, if we think weight is important, why is it important? And how would we actually alter it to improve health? So first we want to know, what is weight comprised? Is it fat? Is it muscle? Is it bone? And what causes it? And we're starting to find out that it's not just infant feeding, but it might be entrained prenatally. So recently, our fellow Meg Parker published this article showing that rapid infant weight gain is predicted by a number of things, but here's one that's really interesting. It's leptin. Leptin is the fullness hormone. And we're finding that leptin predicts slower weight gain in the first 6 months of life, as well as lower body mass index at age 3. And this is perhaps surprising, because later in childhood and adulthood, especially among people who are overweight, leptin predicts more weight gain. So that's when people have already developed leptin resistance. But early in life, maybe they haven't. And in fact, there are some, here we have just a schematic showing that leptin induces less weight gain, induces less obesity. These are positively related. So maybe this is a hormone that actually explains some of these phenomena. And I won't go through this slide except to say there are mouse studies that suggest that there are these critical periods just after birth, well, after birth in the mouse, might be before birth in the human, in which leptin tends to mature neural connections. And if you have too little leptin before or after, it doesn't matter so much. But too little leptin during these few days matters a whole lot about these neural connections that have something to do with appetite. So that's just a way of saying that, you know, these hormones around the time of birth might have a really big impact on setting our trajectories for appetite, and then for calorie intake, and then for development of obesity. So I think we need a new look at infancy. As I was saying, weight gain in early infancy predicts later outcomes. It's not all about infant feeding. The perinatal hormone milieu is important. And now people are looking at many other factors in early infancy that may have an impact. Bisphenol A is an endocrine disruptor. It was in baby bottles almost forever, till very recently. Maybe it has something to do with weight gain. Many people are interested in the microbiota, that is the bacteria that actually live within the intestine. They actually metabolize food differently and may lead to overeating. And we've become very interested in sleep as well. Okay, so the last part of my talk is about prevention. I see I'm running out of time, so I will go through these slides pretty quickly. That's not prevention. Okay, so the first question in prevention is, what do we focus on? So we did this analysis saying, okay, developmental origins of obesity, how important can it be? Let's take a couple prenatal factors that we've looked at, smoking and gestational weight gain. And here's our meta-analysis that we published a couple years ago, showing that smoking during pregnancy is associated with about a 50% increased odds of childhood or adulthood obesity. We also published this a few years ago from Project Viva, showing that those three-year-olds whose mothers gained excessively during pregnancy, according to the guidelines that were in effect at that time, had higher BMI than those who gained inadequately. And we also showed that in the Growing Up Today study, really linear relationship between maternal gestational weight gain and offspring obesity. And we looked at two factors during infancy, infant feeding and sleep duration. This is one of the several meta-analyses on breastfeeding and obesity, showing a 13% decreased odds of obesity among those who had been breastfed versus not. And these are data that we published a couple years ago on sleep, showing that less sleep in the first 2 years of life predicts obesity at age 3, with an odds ratio of about 2 for sleep duration of less than 12 versus greater than 12 hours per day. So we put these all into a model, and we said, okay, so what if your mom had, what if you had optimal levels of these four risk factors? Your mom didn't smoke, gained less weight during pregnancy, breastfed you for at least 12 months, which is the American Academy of Pediatrics recommendation, and you're a good sleeper, 12 hours per day on average. then the predicted probability of obesity at age 3 was 6%. On the other hand, if your mother smoked during pregnancy, gained excessively, didn't breastfeed you as long, and you weren't as good a sleeper, then the predicted probability was 29%. And okay, so this slide shows all 16 combinations of those four risk factors. And you know, here's the 6% and here's the 29%. So I don't know if those are the right number, those are the numbers you'd see in every cohort, but they suggest that changing factors like this might have a big impact. So this developmental approach to prevention holds promise, but what do we focus on and how do we intervene? So one thing to intervene on is gestational weight gain. So you may know that the previous recommendations were in 1990. New recommendations came out last year. A recommendation for obese women. Before this, there was only a minimum gain for obese women. And we know that many women overgain. So in the pregnancy nutrition surveillance system of the CDC, excessive weight gain went up quite a bit in this decade, and Project Viva, 50% of women overgain. So it's a big issue. But when we think about interventions to limit excessive weight gain, we have to recognize that behavior is not easy to change, especially if this is your environment, right? And this says vegetables and fruits, but I challenge anyone to find a vegetable or a fruit. And we also have to remember that we don't want to blame pregnant women for something that they have no control over. For those of you who have teenagers, this might be familiar, so I blame you for everything. Whose fault is that? Nevertheless, women may be willing to change their behavior during pregnancy. And this is not about obesity per se. Maybe it is, but we're not sure yet. This is about fish intake before and after the mercury warnings that came out in 2001. And we were fortunate that Project Viva women were recruited both before and after, so we could look at this time series. And we found that while pregnant women increased their fish intake before, afterwards they had quite a substantial drop and then a decreased slope. So this wasn't a big behavior change intervention. It was more of a simple and not very strong environmental intervention, but still pregnant women changed their behavior. The sidelight to this is I'm not sure this was the right behavior to change, but that's another story. So women are in clinical care frequently during pregnancy, if we think clinical settings are the place to do it. It's only a few months long. We know we can change weight for a few months in non-pregnant adults. And it has the potential to lead to postpartum interventions for the mother and child. And postpartum is preconceptional for the next pregnancy. Coming into pregnancy at an optimal weight is extremely important. But it's hard to measure body composition. We don't have a lot of data on determinants. And it is hard to sustain. So another thing I was doing in Australia was collaborating on this trial, limiting weight gain in overweight and obese pregnant women, called LIMIT. And this is a randomized controlled trial to assess a package of dietary and lifestyle advice to overweight and obese women to restrict weight gain to 0 to 5 kilos, actually below what the IOM recommends. This was started before the IOM recommendations came out, and to see whether you can improve maternal, fetal, and infant health outcomes. So the main trial is funded by the equivalent of the Australian NIH. We also got NIH funding to add anthropometric and physiologic measures in the mother, fetus, and child. And I think it's going to be a very important study because it's a large sample size. It's about 10 times larger than any previous study, which means it's large enough to measure important health outcomes. But of course, there'll be questions: are these the right behavioral components? Is it feasible? Can it be implemented? What about adherence? And the need in the long term to follow the children and the mothers for a number of outcomes, including those related to obesity. And so when we think about these peripartum interventions to prevent obesity and its consequences, we need to think about the mother and the child. We need to think about intervening on multiple factors. We need to think about intervening in multiple settings and having multiple components, so that these interventions can be cost-effective and scalable. So finally, let me conclude by saying, I think in developmental origins of health and disease, We need a new generation of epidemiologic studies that are intergenerational. They take advantage of new designs, and they're in the developing world as well as the developed world, and include minorities. Interdisciplinary approaches are important. I think epigenetics is one example that really brings that to the fore. And our approach to preventive interventions needs to be appropriate to stage of development and systems-based. So with that, I think I will just say thank you. Did you want to take a couple questions now or move on?
I was taking just a number you mentioned earlier on, and that was the 45 cycles of cell division producing newborn. David Barker in his book mentioned, he still uses the number 42, so I'm interested in a more recent citation.
I'm sorry, I can't give you a citation that distinguishes between 42 and 45. Let's think of it as an estimate. I think that the heuristic is that lots of cell divisions happen during these early periods. And that's a way of sort of implying or intimating that, well, reflecting many different developmental processes.